There were incendiaries in Philadelphia. Unknown malicious malefactors were starting fires in warehouses, starting fires in storefronts, starting fires in churches. There were unexplained fires in breweries and barns, workshops, stables, and cellars. Or at least that's what the papers said. Or anyway, that's what the papers said people were saying. Journalistic standards weren't that high back in the year 1820, but you gotta admit they were trying to get the people the news that they needed to know. And even without those news stories, people could hardly help noticing all the fires around town themselves, all the city buildings that were burning down or that just escaped annihilation when a flaming item thrown by some mysterious person or persons was snuffed out just in time by a passerby. Any look through the Philadelphia papers, you'd be sure to see news about wars, treaties, and elections. Yeah, but there just seemed to be so many fires happening. And in almost every story, you'd see that word, incendiaries. Who the incendiaries were, in the mind of Philadelphia's newspaper readers exactly, was never quite clear. Immigrants, perhaps, or criminal gangs of black men, or working-class white ruffians, perhaps, who joined volunteer fire companies just to start fires and then put them out again for the thrill of it, or to collect insurance payments from unscrupulous businessmen. In 1820, Philadelphia was undergoing a transition from being a genteel seaport town, as it had been before, to being a rough-and-tumble center for manufacturing and heavy industry, as it would be from now on. Life felt unsettled. The population was expanding. New buildings were going up, and then suddenly they burned down, and no one knew why. After all, what about the fire that had destroyed the Masonic Hall on Chestnut Street the previous year, March 9th, 1819? Was that not suspicious? That beautiful neo-Gothic structure, the organizational home to the powerful and influential Order of Masons, it was gone overnight. Its tall steeple collapsing into the smoking ruins, despite the efforts of all the city's volunteer firemen. Amazingly, our old friend from Episode 7, the painter John Lewis Crimmel, who so liked to depict the daily life and deeds of Philadelphians, was on hand. He watched as the flames rose from the Masonic Hall, and he sketched away busily, catching the firefighters in the midst of their work. Though it was the middle of the night, he had no trouble seeing his drawing pad. The flames were so bright and rose so high that they could be seen in Newcastle, Delaware, 32 miles away. And now, almost exactly 1 year later, farther up that same block, another Philadelphia landmark, the New Theater, also caught fire. You know, this could not be a coincidence. The Franklin Gazette said, quote, "It was no doubt the work of an incendiary, as there has been no performance in it for a week, the company having left the city for Baltimore. The fire was discovered a little after 7 o'clock yesterday evening. It appears it had been communicated to the scenery. Oh, an attempt was made by some citizens to remove the scenes, but the flames were too rapid and extensive, and in a short time the whole building was in a blaze. In 4 hours, it was entirely consumed." Close quotes. The only items recovered from the theater, said the paper, were the green room mirror, and a model of a ship, and the prompter's clock. All the sets, the extensive costume collection, the musical scores and the orchestra parts, the prompt books, all gone. The gas works, which had only recently been added, making it the first theater in America with a system of gas heat and illumination, well, that was gone too. But the most heartbreaking thing was the loss of the space itself. A theater is burnished over the years by memories, by the communal recollection of shared experience. Any actor or regular audience member can tell you the sensation. You walk into a space where theater, that transitory and that most experiential art form, had been created and shared with other human beings. And immediately the memories come flooding back. And then when that space is lost, you can't go there again. That link to the past is gone. Every news story seemed truly sorrowful to report the loss of the new theater on Chestnut Street, that beautiful and beloved old theater building. Sure, its acting company and its longtime managers, Warren and Wood, were naturally upset, but many of the reporters must also have spent many happy hours in it themselves. The American Daily Advertiser was also sure as to the ultimate cause of the fire. Quote, "There is a reason to believe that this melancholy event was occasioned by some desperately wicked incendiary, and that the horrible deed must have been perpetrated several hours before the fire was discovered." Close quotes. That there was a volunteer fire company in a building literally abutting the theater made it all the more suspicious. The fire was, in fact, first seen near the engine house. How could that have happened? Quote, "We noticed the detection of a bundle of combustibles which had been fired and put under the beams of the Resolution Hose Company," close quotes, declared the Democratic press. Fortunately, the previous night's unseasonable snowfall still covered the roofs of all the adjoining buildings, which dampened any flying embers and kept it from igniting them, which was some relief from all the fire companies who quickly gathered at the new theater to spray water from their hoses on the main blaze. But other reports also said that two villains were discovered trying to cut the firemen's leather hoses with blades concealed in their shoes. And the inmates from the nearby prison, where a riot had broken out and been quelled just 5 days before, oh, they were heard. They were heard cheering on the flames, urging a general destruction of the town. Oh, surely, dark forces were at work. We're only 12 episodes into our overall story of this podcast, but we've already mentioned quite a lot of theater fires. You might remember some of them. The original Federal Street Theater in Boston burned down in 1798, for instance. Ricketts Circus and Art Pantheon in Philadelphia went up in flames in December 1799. The Richmond Theater fire in Virginia, a ghastly event, had killed over 70 people in 1811, as we detailed in our last episode. And in that episode, we also noted the riot and the fire that had destroyed the Vauxhall Garden Theater at the intersection of Philadelphia's Broad and Walnut Streets in September of 1819. You may have thought that all this was an odd fixation of mine. Why so many fires? But I put those stories in there for a reason. Because theater fires were an astoundingly common event in the 19th century, and I don't think that's been covered very well by theater historians. There were a lot of theaters being built in America's burgeoning urban areas in the 19th century, and firefighting and fire prevention were not well developed. So these theaters burned down with alarming frequency. I'm going to talk quite a lot about theater fires today, the ones that happened in the city of Philadelphia mostly, but theater fires, many of them fatal to audience members and performers alike, happened all over the world during that time period. That can't have escaped people's attention. And yet in the 19th century, this fact never seems to have discouraged people from attending the theater for too long. Theater going was such a central part of civilized life back then that the threat of fires was heavily discounted psychologically by most people, kind of like automobile crashes in the 20th century. Oh, sure, it happened, but, you know, not every day. So let's get in the car. Let's go see a show. It wasn't until the disastrous Brooklyn Theater fire in 1876, in fact, which killed almost 300 people, that municipal authorities in America really began to require, by law, that fire prevention and safety measures be present in every theater building. And even then, adoption of these anti-fire measures in theaters was slow, haphazard, and often overlooked in many places. It took the truly hideous death toll of over 600 people in the 1903 Iroquois Theater fire in Chicago until finally prevention efforts were enforced scrupulously and consistently. But to go back to the beginning of the 19th century, Philadelphia theatergoers and theater managers were certainly aware that in London, the Covent Garden Theater was destroyed by fire in 1808, and its companion, the Theater Royal, Drury Lane, had also burned down in 1809, and both of these theaters had to be rebuilt at enormous expense. Here in America, the Park Theater in New York City also burned down in 1820. Now, the owners and the managers of the new theater in Philadelphia had every reason for abundant caution and for their repeated nervous pleas to their patrons not to smoke during the show. Theaters, after all, are just full of things that can easily catch on fire. Curtains, stage drapery, ropes, paint cans, scripts, musical scores, stacks of furniture piled in storage areas, costumes. And now, Warren and Wood literally had a system that piped coal gas through the building. The fire insurance companies of the city were getting nervous with all the talk of incendiaries, and the managers were informed that their fire insurance policy had expired and would not be renewed, and they could not find any other insurance company in the city to take the risk. So they kept performing, but without a fire insurance policy, as their season staggered to the end in March of 1820, as we talked about last time. Even the subscribers, the 150-so businessmen who literally owned the building the theater was in and got free tickets to every show, oh, they were told that their insurance policy would not be renewed at the end of May 1820. So it might seem suspicious these businessmen got reimbursed when the theater caught fire in April, but not Warren and Wood because their policy had expired in February. If this were a modern detective show, we'd certainly point that out with a little musical sting, wouldn't we? Thank you, Chris. So, in the end, what was it? Who burned the new theater down? Incendiaries? Careless smokers? Venal businessmen? An angry theater fan? A disgruntled employee? Well, turns out, it wasn't really that interesting a story. Some spark from a lantern hanging in a window next door fell near the foundation onto a small pile of sawdust or old leaves. It may have smoldered for hours. The workers in a restaurant nearby later said, you know, they'd been smelling smoke faintly all day, but they didn't think it was their problem. The only funny thing is that the lantern that caused the spark, it likely belonged to the very people who were supposed to prevent just such a disaster. That lantern belonged to the Resolution Hose Company, the volunteer firefighting force right next door. And that probably caused some distress and embarrassment because volunteer fire companies in Philadelphia were a big deal. They were a point of civic pride. These companies supported themselves through donations and by organizing fire insurance plans of their own and other means, but racing to fires with their shiny uniforms and their bright wagons and their dogs and their horses. Oh, they were the admiration of all the small children and the heroes of all those whose lives and properties they saved. Popular plays were even written about firefighters back then. However, by the mid-19th century, it was realized that these volunteer fire companies had become a bit of a problem. Violence often erupted between rival companies, and political parties began to employ some members as toughs on election day. On the whole, though, they were doing important work, putting out fires, and often at great personal risk. Many firefighters were injured and died in the course of their duties. There's a lot to discuss here. I don't want to travel down too many byways, though. Originally, when I was making plans for discussing Philadelphia theater fires with you, I thought this would be a multi-episode adventure. I was going to have four of these, and I would spend at least 10 minutes on every single fire that occurred from the beginning of the 19th century up to the beginning of the 20th century. But instead, I've decided to put it all into one episode and go for the larger story arc and keep it more focused on Philadelphia theater, which is, after all, the point of the whole endeavor. And there are about 20 or so really significant fires to discuss. I'm looking at this file that I've created full of newspaper clippings. Each specific theater fire, it seems to me, gets about 3 days of coverage. And if there was a significant loss of life, it might get 2 weeks worth of stories, especially if there were many victims or injured or dead firefighters. And really, to be fair, these events were perfect for newspapers. They seemed to inspire exactly the sort of journalism that major urban newspapers had been created to report about. Fast-paced writing, full of excitement and danger. They really got good at it. There's a story arc with a clear beginning, a middle, and an end to each one. And one other thing. Back then, at the end of all these stories, there would always be an interview with the owner of the theater, and the theater owner would always have an instant and publicly stated resolve to rebuild. Nobody ever just walked away. As William Wood, manager of the new theater, remarked in his memoir that we've quoted so many times, despair was not the fashion of the times. Before that day was over, the two men had taken a lease to move their company to the vacant Walnut Street Theater and had made arrangements to renovate and prepare that former circus for their fall season. And within 2 years, they had rebuilt the Chestnut Street Theater on the same site in a new form, and that building would stand for the next 35 years. They even discovered that the William Rush wooden sculptures of tragedy and comedy that had been standing guard in their alcoves over Chestnut Street in the facade of the theater since 1808 had survived the conflagration. Their architects would place those beloved sculptures in a similar location in the second Chestnut Street Theater as well. However, oh, spoiler alert, within a few years, Warren and Wood went bankrupt. They lost control of the Chestnut Street Theater and it went to someone else. Wood instead became the manager of the new Arch Street Theater, which was built in 1826 on Arch Street, surprisingly enough, between 6th and 7th Street. But by that point, another Philadelphia theater building, long familiar to listeners of the podcast, had already met its fiery end. On May 9th, 1821, the old theater, which had stood on the far side of South Street since 1766 and had hosted everyone from George Washington to Major Andre to John Durang, it went up in flames, too. And again, in the papers, a vague incendiary theory was mentioned, but no cause for the fire was ever found. It was empty at the time, so no lives were lost, though neighboring houses were also destroyed in the blaze. The lower half of the building was salvageable, however, and it was made into a warehouse, and then that became a brewery. In fact, the old theater building lasted until 1912, when it was finally torn down. Now, after the loss of the old theater, there's a gap of about 30 years before there's another major theater fire in Philadelphia, though there were certainly plenty in other parts of the country. And talk about incendiaries in the city pretty much goes away during that period. During this era of Philadelphia theater history, there were really only three prestigious theaters in the city: the Walnut Street Theater, the Chestnut Street Theater, and the Arch Street Theater. And their managers managed to keep them going without them catching fire. Perhaps it was good management or maybe just good luck. But Mr. Wemyss, the longtime manager of the Walnut during the 1830s, always made a point to hold numerous benefit performances with the money going to the volunteer firefighting companies of the city. One year he hosted 24 separate benefits for the firefighters, and perhaps for that reason, whenever a fire broke out nearby the theater, the roof of the Walnut Street was always immediately manned by the hose companies. They sprayed water to prevent firing embers from landing on the roof and igniting it. By 1837, the Chestnut, Arch, and Walnut Street theaters were joined by another more popular grand theater and circus called the National Theater at the corner of 9th and Chestnut. In fact, yet another large auditorium was constructed just to the south of that, on the corner of 9th and what we now call Sansom Street. That was called the Chinese Museum, with an exhibition of Asian artifacts on the lower floors. In 1848, side note, the Chinese Museum even hosted the Whig Party National Convention, nominating the eventually successful ticket of Zachary Taylor and Millard Fillmore for president and vice president. In 1849, the showman P.T. Barnum came to town and expanded into this growing entertainment district of Philadelphia and constructed a Barnum's Museum at the southeast corner of 7th and Chestnut. Not only did this multi-story structure contain a collection of marvels and curiosities, in fact, Barnum had purchased and moved all the contents of the former Peel Museum from Independence Hall there, but it had a large theater in the upper floors where melodramas, pantomimes, and spectacles were presented to the public. On December 30th, 1851, shortly after the conclusion of a performance of a holiday pantomime, Barnum's Museum and Auditorium went up in flames. Fortunately, the audience had all left by that point. However, not only was the theater a total loss, but the long-established Peel Museum collection was destroyed. taking with it many artifacts of Philadelphia history. Now, that area of Chestnut Street, where Barnum's Museum and Theater existed for a short period, had already seen 4 major fires by my count. So now that seems to be somewhat cursed. Maybe it just looks like that to me in retrospect. Nobody mentioned at the times anyway, but it's as good a theory as incendiaries. But here come some more fires. On the July 5th, 1854, the National Theater on 9th and Chestnut on the next block was holding a production of a patriotic play called Putnam about the American general who was the hero of the Battle of Bunker Hill. Now, the conclusion of that play ended with a hail of fake musket fire, naturally, but it seems that the paper wadding of one of the stage muskets flew into the stage carpenter's shop and landed in a pile of shavings. That wadding smoldered while the audience and the actors filed out for the evening and then burst into flames at 10 p.m., and soon the backstage area of the National Theater was ablaze, and then the entire theater was on fire. The conflagration spread to the roof of the Chinese Museum next door on 9th, and despite firefighters' efforts, it too was soon a roaring mountain of red flames, and the entire block, bonded by Chestnut and Sansom between 8th and 9th Street, was totally destroyed. The fire raged for many hours until it ran its course. The Baptist Church and the Walnut Street Theater nearby, to the south, had escaped. It wasn't until the ashes cooled that the remains of one Mr. Shepherd, a solitary actor who had lingered too long in his dressing room after the show, was discovered. His body was horribly burnt and mutilated by falling debris. And another brand new technology was introduced into the reporting of fires. A photograph was taken of the fire's aftermath. I'll put it on the website. Looks kind of like a war zone. But it didn't stay like that. The city of Philadelphia was booming in the 1850s. Business was too good to let prime commercial real estate sit idle for too long. All those burned-over lots were quickly cleared and soon had new buildings filling them. And although the fashionable areas of the city were somehow shifting to the west, the entertainment district largely stayed put. And an enormous new theater, Wheatley Circus, also called the Continental, arose in the middle of the block on Walnut Street between 8th and 9th, just a little bit above the Walnut Street Theater. Originally a circus with performing animals, it instead was converted to a stage where huge spectacles were typically put on. And by this time, elaborate productions of Shakespeare were all the rage, too. And in 1861, a production of Shakespeare's The Tempest was produced there, with a ballet chorus of dozens of beautiful young ballerinas in frilly outfits to accompany the spirit of Ariel as she flew about Prospero's Island to Mendelssohn's music. 4 sisters, Ruth, Cecilia, Hannah, and Adeline Gale, had joined the corps de ballet and were having a glorious time there in Philadelphia at the beginning of their dancing career. But one of the most distressing stories I have to tell you about fire in Philadelphia took place during that production. The dressing rooms of the female ballet corps were behind the stage near Sansom Street, and the rooms were all illuminated by open gas lights high up on the wall, as was common at the time for lighting interior rooms. Ruth Gale had carelessly hung her flimsy dress on a mirror near an open gaslight fixture, and during a quick change, she snatched it down, and the hem of the garment got too near the lamp and was turned into a fireball in her hands. The costume she was already wearing was made out of flimsy gauze, too, and the poor girl immediately found herself engulfed in flames. Ruth's 3 sisters, who were also in the same room, of course, all ran to help her, as did 2 other girls nearby, but they were all themselves wearing highly flammable gauze dresses, too, and, well, it's really too horrible to describe in too much detail. There's a famous engraving of the scene, which appeared in the publication Frank Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper at the time, and I've posted that picture in the blog. You can go take a look at it. Some of the burning dancers even jumped out the back window of the theater onto Sansom Street, and one trailing flames behind her, actually ran out of the dressing room, down the stairs, onto the stage, crashing into glass scenery, which shattered and sliced her. It's hard to tell from the many grisly accounts in the newspaper, but it looks like as many as 13 people eventually died, mostly from seared lungs, some of them days later and after much suffering, and many others who tried to help them were also burned. The four Gale sisters, Ruth, Cecilia, Hannah, and Adeline, were buried side by side in Mount Moriah Cemetery in Philadelphia, a monument with a tender and heartbreaking poem inscribed on it was set over the grave. Well, the mid-Victorian era was really good at funerary monuments and cemeteries and poems, but it failed miserably at fire safety. Because, astoundingly, in the long run, nothing was learned from this appalling object lesson. Just 6 years later, on June 19th, 1867, in that same theater, in that same place, now called the American Theater, they had a fire again. Now, this time it was even more disastrous because when an accidental blaze from an adjoining stable spread to the theater building, the company was in the middle of performing a play. The Black Crook, in fact, the popular and extravagantly produced musical imported from New York. Now again, the stage was full of dancing ballerinas in gauzy, flammable outfits, and hundreds of people were in the audience as smoke began to billow in from under the stage. In the ensuing panic, most people escaped, but a dozen or so audience members died. Eventually, the entire structure went up in flames, and several firemen were killed by the falling walls. Now, at this point, you think, okay, nobody is ever going to build another theater at this location on Walnut Street. It's cursed. But no, by January, just 6 months later, that theater was rebuilt and it was reopening under the same name, and the audience members flocked in to see shows again. Yeah, I can go on with more dismal stories. In the latter half of the 19th century, Philadelphia was booming, its population was swelling to over a million by the end of the 1800s, and though there was never a general conflagration of the type that was to lay waste to huge areas of Chicago in 1871 and Boston in 1872, there were plenty of fires in buildings and factories and businesses all over Philadelphia. The volunteer firefighter system was finally abandoned under the deluge, and a professional Philadelphia fire department was formed, mostly, of course, at first by hiring the former volunteer companies and buying their equipment and engine houses, but eventually a real professional firefighting force was effectively managed. The Philadelphia entertainment industry, like every industry in town, was also expanding. Dozens of theaters were being built in all areas of the city, and with no recognized and generally instituted fire code in the city, inevitably there were more fires in theaters. I'll list a few. November 25th, 1868, the Atlantic Garden Theater on Callow Hill burned, injuring several firemen as its walls tumbled down. October 17th, 1871, Sanford's Opera House, a converted Methodist church turned minstrel show theater, caught on fire, and the interior was entirely burned out. March 20th, 1872, Simmons and Slocum's Opera House, a lovely structure designed and constructed only 2 years before by the eminent Philadelphia architect Edwin Durang, burned, and only the front and back walls survived. It was rebuilt, of course, with a new grand interior, and those walls and interior are actually still standing. However, now it's known as the Trocadero Theater, or the Troc. January 29th, 1874, the new Olympic Theater on 12th and Market Street, a vaudeville house, the second largest theater in the city, caught fire and burned down after only being in business for 7 months. Two firefighters, George Devitt and Charles O'Neill, were killed when its walls collapsed on top of their engine in the street below. February 25th, 1877, Fox's American Theater, another fairly new variety entertainment house on Chestnut Street between 10th and 11th, caught fire and was largely destroyed, with heavy damage being suffered by the adjoining Mercantile Library. A fire insurance inspector was killed. In the wake of all this, and after the 1876 Brooklyn Theater fire I mentioned before, people across America finally began to take notice and do something about it. Iron fire escapes began to be placed on the exterior of all buildings, especially those of theaters and auditoriums. But on the whole, the theater-going public remained blithely casual. There was no fall-off in the demand for entertainment. Even in Philadelphia, as the city hosted the great 1876 Centennial Exhibition, and hundreds of new and flimsy temporary structures were raised all over the city, there was not a widespread concern about fires. In a pamphlet entitled Notes on the Burning of Theaters and Public Halls, author J.M. Toner meditated on this fact. Quote, "The current of life hurries on so swiftly that the mind soon becomes oblivious to events from which we think we can never recover. The hopefulness and buoyancy of our nature render the traditional 9 days' wonder too short for us to look for the cause and seek for a preventative against a recurrence. But the fact that there is scarcely a place of public amusement of many years' standing in any of our large cities that has not at some time been burned, and the principal ones a number of times, may astound us." Close quotes. Clearly, this situation could not continue. American cities were striving to become less chaotic and less dangerous to human life in general by the end of the century. Building engineers, architects, and theater managers were finally insisting on taking some sort of proactive measures about the issue. Philadelphia, which had always been a center for science and practical problem solving, set to the task. On April 18, 1883, the meeting was held at the Franklin Institute, a longtime center for practical science and engineering, on 15 South 7th Street. The Committee on the Prevention of Fires in Theaters, led by C. John Hexamer, a civil engineer, submitted its report. The long and sorry history of fatal and disastrous fires in public theaters throughout the world was explored in the report, and, drawing on the work of architects and engineers in Germany and England and elsewhere, it proposed a list of 38 measures that every theater building and auditorium in America should thereafter possess. The report concluded, quote, "Your committee, in closing this report, cannot help referring to two most necessary factors in reforming our theater. One, the education of the public on this subject by popular lecture, articles, and papers. And two, the cooperation of prominent mechanics and scientists. The problem of building theaters properly is eminently one of the mechanical engineer, and will never be solved if the technical resources of our age are not taken into account and brought to bear on the question." Close quote. So, what were the 38 measures that the Hexamer Report recommended? Well, they were many of the very things that we today take for granted about almost every theater auditorium we know. Sufficient fire exits, marked in large bold letters, and broad corridors in every theater leading to fire doors that always open outwards. Sufficient fire extinguishers and hose connections throughout the building. Use of fireproof materials in stage curtains. And in the audience section, rows that have aisles allowing people to leave quickly if necessary, and chairs that are bolted to the floor and have automatic springs to let the seat bottom swing up quickly and upwards and out of the way. Automatic sprinkler systems over the stage and in the backstage areas. Ground plans of the theater clearly displayed for audience members and firefighters alike. And a designated set of theater employees trained in firefighting techniques. Regular inspections by fire marshals. And most of all, the committee recommended better coverings for gas lamps. And even better, it said, why not do what the Savoy Theater in London had just done 2 years before? Install electric lights. And sure enough, theaters in Philadelphia were in fact soon adding electricity to their equipment, both for reasons of safety and because the new stage effects that electric light could create. And throughout the city of Philadelphia, everyone was installing electricity in their homes and in their businesses, and utility poles crammed with telephone lines and telegraph and electric wires were being strung along every street. Now, admittedly, these poles and wires also provided an enormous amount of physical and visual clutter, especially in the older parts of the city where the sidewalks were the narrowest. But the installation of electricity into the city's theaters, especially into its older existing spaces, was not without its hazards, particularly if it was not done properly. And, of course, it was a theater along that same old stretch of Chestnut Street that provided so many stories for us today. That provided the first example of an electrical fire. You remember the Gothic Revival Masonic Temple on Chestnut, which burned down in 1819? Well, it was eventually succeeded in 1853 by another Gothic Revival Masonic Temple. As we've noted, it's fairly common for calamities to keep occurring at the same locations for some reason. Well, the Masons had built their brand new Norman Gothic Temple on Broad Street, north of City Hall, by the 1870s, and the old building had become a grand performance venue, called, of course, the Temple Theater. It also hosted an Egyptian museum, which held wax sculptures arranged in tableau of historical figures and of biblical events. It was fitted with both gas illumination and the newfangled electric lights for manager John G. Brotherton's production of a musical comedy called The Little Tycoon. Ironically, it was the electrical wiring for the theater which sparked and ignited some drapery in the hall on December 27th, 1886. The resulting fire destroyed the entire theater. Though amazingly, the wax tableau of the crucifixion of Christ was saved, and some people thought this was a sign of something, but this statuary rescue was not likely a comfort to the families of the firemen who were killed while putting out the blaze. Speaking of cursed grounds, we next turn to the middle of the block bounded by Walnut and Sansom Streets between 8th and 9th. On March 24th, 1888, it's at the same location where, as we have heard, two mass casualty fires had already occurred. The latest theater at that location, the Grand Central Theater, this one was called, burned down along with all the scenery and the costumes for the show called The Night Owls. Also destroyed was the adjoining Comique Theater on Sansom Street, although that was really less of a theater than it was a gentleman's club for girly shows and pool tables and boxing matches. At this time, the fire struck in the middle of the night, possibly caused by a faulty heating duct, and no lives were lost. Amazingly, once again, the luck of the Walnut Street Theater on the corner immediately to the west continued, and it still stood, unaffected by the loss of yet another one of its neighbors. And again, real estate was at a premium in the crowded city, and businessmen were immediately, eagerly snapping up the rights to build on that lot again. And astoundingly, another theater was immediately constructed in that same spot. This one was called the Central Theater. To its rear, on Sansom Street, the Philadelphia Times, one of the most popular newspapers in the city, constructed an imposing 8-story annex with its engraving and printing plants inside, along with the offices of the editors and its publisher. Well, all I can say is they might know the news, but everyone was ignoring history, and we all know not to do that, right? Right? Well, evidently not. On April 27th, 1892, just 4 years later, fire struck for the fourth, or is it the fifth? I'm losing count. Time at a theater in this area of Walnut Street. The grand and popular production being shown that night at the Central Theater was entitled, ominously, The Devil's Auction. As the Philadelphia audience was still filing in and the orchestra was about to start the overture, the stagehands were sending up a border drapery on the opening set, a pretty Mexican scene with a stagecoach in the background. The drapery came in contact with the border lights up above, and suddenly All was chaos. The manager, William Gilmore, was on the stage immediately, and he knew his theater was doomed. "The house is gone. Get everybody out," he yelled. "Get your people out."
The cast and the crew were running off the stage, and the audience members were clawing for the exits.
There were fire extinguishers backstage, and some of the crew attempted to use them on the blazing curtains, but they proved inadequate. The flames rocketed up into the flyworks above the stage, and then the roof caught fire. This time, at least, there seems to have been an adequate number of exit doors, and the people in the balconies clambered onto the exterior fire escapes which had been built, but panic caused some folks to act in awful ways. One man, with a knife, literally slashed his way through the crowd out onto Walnut Street, screaming at people to get out of his way as he ran. Other people trampled each other on the fire escapes, and many of them fell off. Bones were broken, heads and chests were crushed, and the performers in the dressing rooms beneath the Central Theater stage were the worst off. 6 of them died there when an escape stair collapsed. One young woman, Mae Courtney, who had been putting on her makeup when the fire alarm was given and was wearing nothing but a pair of tights, jumped up and caught the edge of the hole which the falling stairway had left behind, and she pulled herself into the middle of the flaming stage. She leapt over the orchestra pit, catching her foot on the bass drum, and she fell, and she momentarily fainted, and then she was called back to consciousness by the manager, Gilmore, shouting in her ear. So she got up and she ran blindly through the smoke and out the front door of the theater, strolled naked across Walnut Street and into Zeiss's hotel, where somebody finally gave her a dress to wear. And Mr. Gilmore made it out too. Fire trucks were now arriving, but they were too late to save the structure. The Times building to the rear went up in a colossal tower of flame, most of its employees saved when they ran down the fire stairs. So some precautions that architects and engineers now routinely took against catastrophe were working, after all. And while the fire raged at the Central Theater, just a few dozen yards away, at the Walnut Street Theater, another audience was settling into their seats for a play called Imagination. The Walnut's assistant manager, E.P. Simpson, was standing in the empty theater lobby. He heard someone yell, "Fire!" and ran outside onto Walnut Street and saw the flames rising from the neighboring Central Theater's roof and the panicking crowd swarming onto the fire escapes. He hurried back inside the Walnut and found the producer of the play now getting underway on stage, Edwin L. Price. The two men knew that they would have to get every person out of the theater, but they knew that that also risked a dangerous mass panic, which could spread just as easily as fire. They quickly arrived at a plan of action. Price sauntered calmly onto the stage after the overture had finished and announced that a leading actor in the play was suddenly too ill to perform that night, and the performance, I'm sorry to say, ladies and gentlemen, is canceled. If everyone would just go home, he would honor their tickets on another occasion. Oh, and by the way, there does seem to be a small incident happening nearby in the neighborhood, and out of an abundance of caution, perhaps this is a good time for everyone to find the nearest exit. Thank you. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. The audience quietly filed out of the building without panic or jamming the exits, only learning when they got outside that they had been in real danger all the time. Meanwhile, the resourceful E.P. Simpson, he'd gone to the Walnut's roof with the theater employees who constituted the staff fire brigade, and they poured water on any spark or flaming debris that reached the Walnut Street Theater's roof. Once again, the old house had survived, and once again, the Hexmer Report's recommendations had shown their worth. But the Central Theater, complete loss. The newspapers, except for the Philadelphia Times, which had lost its printing plant, were full of the story for days afterwards. As usual, the public attention died away. Producer William Gilmore took the insurance money and built another new theater on that same site. This one called Gilmore's Auditorium. A solid pile of reassuring brick, it looked like a fortress, and it was billed to the public as being fireproof. And indeed, it must have been, because this theater, at last, did not burn down. Starting as a legitimate house, it hosted musicals, plays, and lectures for many years. In 1905, it was renamed the Casino Theater and started showing vaudeville. By 1920, it was a burlesque house, one of the most notorious ones in the city. In 1935, during the Great Depression, it was torn down. That center section of the block on Walnut became an empty parking lot. Indeed, it remained so almost 100 years later. Because, on the whole, that's how theaters meet their end in Philadelphia in the 20th century. We tore them down. We got pretty good at stopping them from burning down by then. We just forgot how to fill them with audiences. And then we forgot what to do with them. And then we threw a lot of them away. And we seem to really like parking lots. But that's another story. I'll get to that in a later episode. The government of the city of Philadelphia, which by the end of the 19th century was settling deep into the state one journalist famously called corrupt and contented, was not fast to respond to the Philadelphia Fire Department's repeated requests for a citywide high-pressure water system and other improvements in firefighting, not until the city government could figure out who got cut in on the deal anyway. But that high-pressure pumping system was finally installed citywide, 1902, 1903. The pumping station for that system at the foot of Ray Street near the docks, which drew water directly from the Delaware River, was fully operational by the beginning of 1904. It was highly effective until it, too, was eventually decommissioned when times and firefighting technology changed, as they do and as they continue to do. Speaking of changes, that pumping station at Delaware and Ray's is now a restaurant and theater, the home of the Philadelphia Fringe Arts Festival. You can see plays there. Like all great theater spaces, it's both a safe and at the same time an exciting place. And all the fire exits are clearly marked. I'm Peter Schmitz, and the sound and music are by Christopher Mark Colucci. Thanks for coming along on another adventure in theater history, Philadelphia. Hi, everybody. A few more things before we go. We really want to thank Susie for becoming a supporting member of the show on Patreon, where we have additional blog posts and bonus episodes. We are deeply grateful for her kindness and her generosity. And also, we want to thank Kelly, who just became a Patreon member, too. She is also a researcher into 19th century theater history, and she has already given me a lot of great ideas and inspiration, too. Thank you. Everyone else, go to our website, aithpodcast.com, where there is a blog post about this episode, and there's an easy button to click on if you too want to become a Patreon supporter, or you can just buy me a coffee. You can write a review of the show on the website, and you can leave us a voicemail if you have a story that you want to tell us about Philadelphia theater history. What I also recommend, by the way, if you are in Philadelphia, is visiting the Fireman's Hall Museum in a former fire station on 2nd Street in Old City, right near Elfrith's Alley. Their collection of historic fire equipment and their mission of preserving the history of the Philadelphia Fire Department is a vital link to our city's past. Check it out. Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.